Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners. Hello and welcome to As It Is, the current events program for podcast and broadcast from VOA Learning English. I'm Jonathan Evans in Washington. On today's program, we tell you about a new development in America's growing private space industry. But first, we tell you about a community in Nairobi, Kenya, that is reducing cost in another way by using a non-official currency. Mary Gottschall joins us with her story on community currencies.
At the Sifa Primary School outside Nairobi, Kenya, students pay their tuition with a new local currency called the pesa. The school is one of several institutions that accepts the community currency. Teacher Josephine Uma says the currency has made life easier. The currency is widely used by people in the Katina village where she lives. The pesas are equal in value to the Kenyan shilling and can be spent in the community just like cash. The new currency gives poor people more buying power than they would otherwise have. If members of the community have a shortage of the national currency, they can use the community currency to get access to the goods and services they may need, said Ruth Mwangi with Grassroots Economics. Community currency programs are being set up by nonprofit organizations across the world. Although they are called currencies, they are really a regional form of exchange, or barter. They help poor communities increase trade and create jobs, according to Grassroots Economics, based in Mombasa, Kenya. It does not replace, but rather supplements, the national currency system, reported the nonprofit group. Here's how community currency works. A nonprofit group, like Grassroots Economics, organizes local businesses into a commercial barter club. Each business is given an initial amount of credit by the other businesses. These credits are backed by the goods and services of each participating business. The credits can be exchanged for various goods and services at any business in the network. A portion of the credits is collected as a tax by the nonprofit organization. This is used to fund public service projects in the community, like road maintenance or trash collection. These alternative currencies are growing in popularity and are used in a variety of local communities around the world, including Europe, Africa, and the U.S. For example, Bay Bucks is a community currency used in San Francisco. You earn Bay Bucks every time a business purchases your goods or services on the exchange. And you can spend the Bay Bucks you earn when you want to purchase anything in the Bay Bucks marketplace, according to their website. Let's say Albert is a baker who needs help filing his taxes. He contacts Betty, a bookkeeper in the network, and pays her 500 Bay Bucks for her tax preparation services. Betty pays Albert 50 Bay Bucks for some bagels to serve at her next meeting. She also pays Charlie, a web designer in the network, 300 Bay Bucks to design a new logo. And on it goes, stimulating business in the local economy. Grassroots Economics has given pesas to about 500 locals in Katina Village. Each member receives a maximum of 400 pesos. Of these, 200 are saved and pooled for community improvement projects. The rest can be spent like cash. Those 500 people are just a small percentage of the roughly 10,000 people living in Gatina Village. Grassroots Economics said it started with a small number of members so they can monitor the currency. Francis Nyeguna, a shop owner in the village, said, "There are some challenges with the currency, since there are a lot of people who have not accepted its use. But I believe that once we educate them on it, they will accept it, since many more are joining as we continue to enlighten them." Traditional national currencies are issued by the government and backed by banks in those countries. For example, the British pound is backed by the Bank of England. But community currencies are based on a system of trust among local residents, explained Simon Wolfe. He is managing director of the Brixton Pound, a community currency used in the South London district of Great Britain. The Brixton Pound was launched in 2009. Wolfe said in a TEDx talk that community currencies stimulate local trade and the local economy. I'm Mary Gottschall.
After a short break, we will tell you about a new development in America's space industry. SpaceX is a private spaceflight company led by businessman Elon Musk. Dan Friedel tells us how the company may have succeeded in changing how rockets put cargo into space.
The video of the massive SpaceX rocket landing safely back on Earth was like the takeoff, but in reverse. The rocket is called Falcon 9, and the safe landing is a big deal. It means that space travel could become a lot easier in the future. Normally, rockets deliver their payload, a satellite, for example, or supplies, and then burn up on their way back to Earth. What the SpaceX mission proved is that a rocket may be able to safely return to Earth and be used again. The successful landing is even more notable considering a similar rocket failed when it launched 6 months ago. The way it works is that the entire rocket unit leaves Earth's atmosphere, and then the 15-story tall rocket booster separates, flips, and comes back to a landing zone 6 miles away. If the rocket booster can be used again, it means the cost of entering space can be significantly reduced. For example, similar boosters cost $60 million to build, but are only used once. If SpaceX is a success, it will cost $60 million once, and then future missions will only include the cost of repairs and fuel. The owner of SpaceX is businessman Elon Musk. He also owns the Tesla electric car company. A company called Orbcomm hired SpaceX to deploy 11 satellites. That part of the mission was a success, too. Musk says his real goal is to send a human mission to Mars. This was a critical step along the way to being able to establish a city on Mars. That's what all this is about. The rocket launch and landing took place in Cape Canaveral, Florida, a city famous for many other successful rocket launches, but none where the booster returned in one piece. Observers say the test will have to be repeated several times to prove that it is possible to reuse space rockets. I'm Dan Friedel.
And that's our program for today. Keep listening for our latest report on science, followed by our American history program, The Making of a Nation.
Coming up, more programs designed for English learners. You can read and listen to our reports and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
On today's science report, we hear how researchers are trying to learn how to help the brain heal from serious injuries. Researchers at Rice University say brain cells called neurons are about to regenerate. That might mean people with brain injuries could recover from damage caused by strokes and other kinds of trauma. Dan Friedel joins us again for this report on the science of the brain's ability to heal.
A group of researchers at Rice University in Texas are learning how to help the brain heal from serious injuries. Brain cells, called neurons, connect with each other through chemical and electrical signals. They form networks. They use proteins to grow. The researchers want to find out if they can direct the growth of neurons and help them form these important links. If the researchers can understand this process, they think they will be able to help people who have suffered brain injuries stimulate new nerve tissue. Amina Kutub is a bioengineer who studies the brain. She studies what happens when a person's brain does not receive enough oxygen. When the brain lacks oxygen, it is having a stroke. Kutub says scientists used to think brain cells were static. That means everyone was born with a limited number of brain cells, and the number of those cells could never increase. But a lot of new research shows we're able to regenerate nerve cells, she says. Kutub works with an electrical engineer and a biologist on the research team. The goal is to learn how to repair parts of the brain that are damaged in a stroke. Brains can be damaged by a degenerative disease like Alzheimer's disease, or in a traumatic injury, such as getting hit in the head. The networks the brain forms are called neural networks, and they are complex. Preneurons are even harder to understand.
They form very elaborate and beautiful networks, and the different network structures relate to what they do, their function. And what we're trying to do is figure out what are the chemical signals that lead to a particular structure, and in turn, how does that structure relate to the electrical signals you get when you have active neurons?
The Rice research is supported in part by President Barack Obama's $300 million Brain Initiative, which is modeled after the Human Genome Project. Kutub says the research opens up a huge door to better understanding the brain. A small, tropical fish is contributing to the research. It is called a zebrafish because of its stripes. Zebrafish embryos are being used by the research team because their embryos are transparent. That way they can see a living brain work. Kutub says that is not possible with humans. In zebrafish, we can watch the neural progenitor cells become neurons. The research program will create a computer model. That model will help researchers get a better idea of how the brain works. One day, they may be able to provide better treatment for people with brain injuries. I'm Dan Friedel. Thank you.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. In our last program, we told you how the flow of immigration to the United States began to change in the 1880s. Before then, most of the immigrants came from Central and Northern Europe, from Britain, Ireland, Germany, and the Scandinavian countries. The largest number came from Britain. They found it easy to settle in a country that, until 1776, was a collection of British colonies. The newcomers from Britain shared the same language with the Americans and many of the same traditions. Some of these early immigrants were skilled workers who found good jobs in American industry. Others were farmers who came to America for free land. This week in our series, Robert Bostick and Jack Weitzel continue the story of immigration in the United States.
After 1880, the flood of immigration from Northern and Central Europe began to fall. Now, most immigrants were coming from Eastern and Southern Europe, from Russia, Poland, Romania, Italy, Greece. These new immigrants were different from those who came earlier. Most did not speak English. Most were poor farmers who had few special skills. Most had little or no education. They were, however, good workers. They did not protest working long hours for low pay. They did not demand better working conditions. They usually refused to join labor unions or take part in strikes.
American factory owners were pleased with the new immigrants. They gave them jobs formerly held by higher-paid American workers. The owners asked the new workers to write letters to friends still in the old country, urging them to come to America. And they came by the hundreds of thousands to take jobs in steel factories in Pennsylvania and the coal mines of West Virginia. They worked in the lumber camps of Michigan and in the stockyards and the meatpacking plants of Chicago. American workers then began to protest as their jobs were filled by immigrants who were happy to work for less money.
The protests were especially bitter on the Pacific coast, where thousands of Chinese immigrants were settling in California. The Chinese arrived there after 1850 to help build Western railroads. After the railroads were completed, these Chinese newcomers turned to other jobs. More came every year. By the 1870s, California's political leaders were demanding an end to further immigration from China. In 1882, Congress passed a law that barred Chinese immigration for 10 years. The law was extended for another 10 years, then made permanent.
The immigration law of 1882 put other limits on immigration. It closed the country to criminals, the mentally ill, and persons who could not support themselves. Later, others were added to this list: persons with diseases, anarchists, alcoholics. This, however, did not greatly reduce immigration from Eastern and Southern Europe, and opponents of immigration demanded stronger action. Some proposed a literacy test. Immigrants would have to show that they could read and write. An immigrant who could not would not be permitted to enter the country.
Senator Henry Cabot Lodge of Massachusetts urged Congress to pass such a law. In a Senate speech, Lodge said, "If we care for the welfare, the wages, or the standard of life of American working men, we should take immediate steps to limit foreign immigration. There is no danger to our working men from the coming of skilled workers or of trained and educated men. But there is a serious danger from the flood of unskilled, ignorant foreign labor. This labor not only takes lower wages, but accepts a standard of living so low that the American working man cannot compete with it." Senator Lodge continued, "A literacy test will bear very lightly, if at all, upon English-speaking immigrants or Germans, Scandinavians, and French. The races which would suffer most under a literacy test would be those with which the English-speaking people have never united, and who are most different from the great majority of the people of the United States." Congress passed the proposal. President Cleveland, however, vetoed it. He said the nation had nothing to fear from immigrants who could not read or write. He said there was greater danger from some of the educated immigrants who urged violence and anarchy. It took a number of years before Congress was able to pass a law demanding a literacy test for immigrants.
Another problem troubled President Cleveland: high tariffs, taxes on imports. Soon after his election, Cleveland decided to learn what he could about the tariff. "I'm sorry to say," said Cleveland, "but the truth is, I know nothing about the tariff." Cleveland studied all the information he could find about the tariff. He found that the tariff was used not only to get money for the government, but to protect American industry from foreign competition. The tariffs had been raised so high that they were producing more money than the government needed. Cleveland decided that high tariffs were wrong. He told other Democratic leaders that he would try to get them reduced. The politicians warned him not to try. They said he would only lose the support of businessmen. They said he would need campaign money from business if he expected to be elected president again. But Cleveland rejected their advice. He said, "What is the use of being elected or re-elected if you don't stand for something?"
So, late in 1887, Cleveland sent a tariff message to Congress. He said it was wrong to raise more tax money than the government needed. "When this happens," he said, "money is withdrawn from the people's use and kept in the public treasury where it does no good. It threatens the economy and invites dishonest attempts to use the money for private interests. The government," he said, "received most of this unnecessary tax money from tariffs." He said the present tariff laws were vicious, unfair, and illogical. He said they raised the prices of all imported goods which could be taxed. They also led American manufacturers to raise their prices as high as those charged for imported goods. Cleveland said some men had become rich because protective tariffs let them charge high prices. He noted that American businessmen like to talk about the strength and success of American industry. But he said that when the question of the tariff is raised, businessmen claim that industry is weak. They say they cannot compete with low-priced foreign products.
Cleveland said he did not propose that all tariffs be ended. He said some were needed to raise money for the government. And he said some industries could not exist unless they were protected by tariffs. But he said tariffs should not let some industries make huge profits. Cleveland warned that it would be far better to make safe, careful, and intelligent changes in the tariff laws now. Otherwise, he said, there might come a time when an angry public would demand radical and sweeping changes.
The House of Representatives moved quickly to pass a moderate bill that would reduce many of the tariffs. The legislation, called the Mills Bill, was exactly what Cleveland wanted. But the bill ran into trouble in the Senate, where Republicans had control. Senator William Allison, a Republican from Iowa, proposed a different tariff bill. It was one that would increase tariffs, not reduce them. The Senate debated the tariff question for months, and since it was 1888, a presidential election year, the tariff became an important election issue. The Democrats promised low tariffs that would mean lower prices for the people. The Republicans defended high tariffs, which they said were necessary to protect American industry and labor. The Democrats nominated Grover Cleveland for another 4-year term. The Republicans held their nominating convention 2 weeks later. That will be our story next week.
Our program was written by Frank Beardsley. The narrators were Robert Bostick and Jack Weitzel. You can find our series online with transcripts, MP3s, podcasts, and images at voaspecialenglish.com. You can also follow us on Facebook and Twitter at VOA Learning English. Join us again next week for The Making of a Nation, an American history series in VOA Special English.